Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and it's raining, isn't it?
Well, it seems like it always does that, but it's good for the farmers. It's good for the crops, unless they get too much rain.
And then they get flooding.
Yeah, so it seems like farmers always complain about the weather. And our resident farmer, Ann's mother, while she was living with us, she used to complain about the weather, too. Right. It was too hot, it was too cold, it was too wet, it was too dry. But some ingredients that we love seem to manage to survive all those difficulties, and perhaps it's because they're kind of where they come from is kind of spread out. But if there's a title for today's program, it is indeed ingredients that we love and the characters who produce them.
Yeah, well, I like the characters most of all.
Of course, the characters.
The products are very good, but I just think the stories are fascinating.
Well, the characters are who we talk to anyway. I mean, it's, yeah. I don't think we would make much of a program out of chewing Vincent's cranberries on the air. But having the Vincent family talk about cranberries, now that's really very interesting. And this is a family with a history that goes back in the cranberry business to 1950. A part of the country that isn't usually associated with cranberries, and a really fascinating story.
Tim Vincent is going to tell us about cranberries, everything about cranberries. Tim, Vincent Cranberries is a family business, and it's, as you said, entering its fourth generation. You have given birth to the fourth generation already. How far does it go back? You said your grandfather. What year is this when he started planting cranberries?
Yeah, so my grandfather down on the south coast of Oregon started in the cranberry business as a part-time gig back in 1957.
Okay.
And so the lifestyle of a cranberry farmer back then was very much a part-time thing. They would be maybe a commercial salmon fisherman for part of the year, work in the mills for part of the year, and then just a fresh fruit cranberry farmer for part of the year.
Is that because the seasonality of cranberries?
It's the seasonality, absolutely. And there was no such thing as commercial cranberry juice at the time.
No such thing, huh? Well, you started out with cranberries, per se, right? Did you sell them fresh and dried, or just fresh, or how?
Just fresh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep, that's been our primary business for many years.
Yeah, and Tim mentioned that Ocean Spray, I guess, is a cooperative that goes all over the country, and you used to be a part of that cooperative.
Yeah, our family, multiple generations of our family have been a member of the co-op for years. Our family in particular left about 10 years ago.
Okay.
So independent.
And what was behind that?
Well, for the co-op rules going back a long time allowed some restrictions on the amount of growth of acreage that could be added on a yearly basis.
Uh-huh.
And as the co-op got bigger and bigger, and as the juice industry expanded so quickly, they really took the cap off of that. And, you know, the expansion of acreage so dramatically really, really made the price go down to the degree where a small farmer who didn't have a lot of automation, the economy of scale didn't allow for us to make a profit.
Okay, so, yeah, that was in some of the background information that you sent us. You said it was taking you several months into the year to make the payment to the bank, and basically you were slowly but surely losing the business. So you decided, well, we better do something about that, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, we were looking at a situation for many years, we had no debt against the farm, to where that just flip-flopped, and we were just accumulating more and more just to be able to pay the bills.
Well, but you reinvented the business, and I think that your product is so superior that most people wouldn't even understand the difference until they tasted yours as opposed to some of these commercial brands.
Thank you.
Well, you mentioned some percentages just a few minutes ago before we went on the air. It's really dramatic. So the cranberry juice cocktail, which has commercially available, that has the largest percentage of cranberry juice in it, the percentage is how much?
It's 27%, so on the market of all blended cranberry juices, anything other than the 100% straight that you can buy on the shelf for $9, $10 to $12, if it's a blended cranberry juice, it has no more than 27% cranberry juice.
Now, you flip that totally around with this new product line, and let's just pop a statistic in there, because I think it's a really remarkable statistic, and then talk to us about the product itself. You said even in the cranberry juice with blueberry, which is the first one we tried, the percentage of cranberry juice is?
From 60% cranberry all the way up to 94% at our highest.
And it tastes pure. I mean, the thing about this beverage is it is clean, it is pure, and you get what you're trying to buy. You're getting cranberry juice.
But what made you decide that this particular way was the way to go, Tim?
Well, I grew up on a cranberry farm, and I know what a cranberry is supposed to taste like. And I had envisioned, when I was thinking of making a juice, I envisioned what would it take like if I was going to make a blend, say, of a cranberry and a blueberry juice. What would it taste like if I had a cranberry and a blueberry in my hand and I popped it in my mouth? And vision was that the front, the name of the juice would match the ingredient panel. And there was no way to do that if we followed the existing model on the market, which was call it a cranberry blueberry juice, but it would be, you know, 60-70% apple juice. Which I felt
terrible.
Was not just a truth in labeling backdoor, so to speak.
Yeah, why do they let them get away with that?
Because if you read the label, it says cranberry and other fruit flavors, right?
Right, yeah. Well, there's no requirement that they list the percentage of each ingredient, only the order of
right.
it. So there's juices out there that, for instance, there's a cranberry pomegranate. And you turn around the label, and cranberry is its third ingredient.
So that means it's all these other things. Yeah.
And pomegranate is probably the fifth ingredient.
Yeah, exactly. And apple and water would be its first and second, or so on. So
isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Well, what gave you this idea, though, to suddenly go into juices? You and your wife did this sort of on your own, and then your brother, who's also in the business, discovered it, or what?
The family is, my brother runs the farm. It's too small of a farm for two brothers. And so I've actually lived in the Portland area, in the metropolitan area, just working for the man, so to speak, for a number of years. And watching the desperation and the loss of hope, not just in my family, but a lot of the cranberry farmers in the southern coast area, it's just really hard to watch. And last year, when things really reached a head, where it looked like we were kind of at the last stages, maybe one more bank payment could be made, but maybe not. We just kind of got angry and walked through a grocery store called the New Seasons Natural Market up here and saw that the price of the juices, I was just thinking, you know, the price of cranberry juices keeps going up, but the price of a cranberry is lower than it was in the 80s. Why is...
Yeah, somebody's sucking money and it's not you guys, right?
Right, and there is no other cranberry farm, single cranberry farm, that makes its own cranberry juice. So all other cranberry juices will come from an anonymous potpourri of different farms. And so we thought, you know what? We grow great cranberries. Why should we get the same standard price as someone who may or may not grow great cranberries, or even cranberries that come from China or somewhere else? Let's put a Vincent name on it, and let's ask for people to decide whether or not it's worth it.
That's great.
So that's what you did?
That's what we did.
In the meantime, you did keep your day job.
I did keep my day job. I'm happy to report that I was able to leave that day job.
Oh, that's wonderful. So this really worked, huh?
It really worked. And I was just up in Seattle last weekend and was able to bring my 11-year-old son with me, and we went and did some tastings at what they call a Metropolitan Market up there and then a Central Co-op. And just seeing my son behind, passing out the little samples of the juice,
aww,
was such a treat. In the industry I worked at before, I really couldn't even pick them up from school, busy with work, and I was missing lots of things. But now I can do that, and it's like having a farming lifestyle in my existing life here up in Portland.
Now tell me this. You know that commercial on television where the father and his dumb son are standing up into their almost to their waist in cranberry bog?
Yeah.
Is that for real what it's like?
So, well, I'll break that down into two pieces.
Okay.
Yes, if there
I
is
hate
water,
that commercial, by the way.
Amen to that. And actually, you got my blood boiling a little bit when you started asking that question. So, yes, the bogs are flooded for harvest. It's a very short period of time. They're not flooded all year round.
Okay.
But the bigger thing I'm breaking down is that this is a co-op of farmers that is making that commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's making fun of farmers. And you know what? Farmers are, they're a cross between scientists, artists, mechanics, wizards. They are some of the smartest people and the most plugged into the realities of life. To see someone who is just an actor or whatever portray these bumbling fools.
Yes, exactly.
I don't really appreciate that.
No, I understand. Now, why would smart people? Why would you want to make fun of yourself? I mean, that's,
yeah, I don't understand
something is wrong with that.
What's the appeal of this commercial? Because it's been on for ages and ages now.
I'm not sure. Well, maybe Ocean Spray Corporation doesn't really understand their market all that well.
And even if it's meant tongue in cheek and not make fun of the farmer, we know that the consumer doesn't really respond to that, by and large. Or maybe they do, I don't know. But I can tell you that the ones who I meet face-to-face and want to learn about our juice, our family, what we're trying to do, they're the ones that care about the product.
Now, we've got four products that we're sampling right now, and there's a fifth that apparently we didn't try. Why don't you go through the portfolio?
Sure. So our first blend that didn't even have a nutritional panel on it, or a UPC code, because we just thought we would just be selling in farmers markets, was the cranberry with raw agave. And then we had we came out with the cranberry blueberry juice, mm-hmm. which is that's our most intense, is the word I like to say. And then just in the last month, we kind of exploded out with three new blends. There's a cranberry marionberry. And folks who aren't familiar with what a marionberry is it's a Northwest specific breed of blackberry.
Oh,
okay,
wow.
So it's a blackberry.
It is a blackberry, and it is I'll find a way to send you some marionberries, because they are designed to survive in a hardy Oregon environment.
Uh-huh.
And when we put those same marionberries in like a valley or an area that's more protected, they become even more juicy and more black. So they're a really great berry that we're proud of being able to represent Oregon there. We have a cranberry apple that, as you know, we've talked about apple juice as a primary ingredient in a lot of cranberry juices. We felt that we wanted to show people what a real cranberry apple is and not an apple cranberry. So this obviously has a lot more cranberry juice than apple. Going back to that idea of what it would taste like to have the fruits in your hand. Put a green apple in your hand, put a handful of cranberries, pop it in your mouth. That's what this would taste like. It's pretty hardcore, so to speak. And then the final one that we just came out with is a cranberry palm nectar. And
what?
That is, it's an interesting one. So it's a nectar from the coconut palm frond.
Really?
And as a small producer, that very small batches, if we want to add a blend or make a change, we don't have a board of directors, we don't have shareholders we got to talk to, we just decide to do it. And we got excited when one of our customers mentioned this palm nectar and brought us some.
Uh-oh.
And apparently when you take the coconut palm frond, just like you would sugar cane, you can process it into a nectar. And it's a very powerful sweetener. And it's an organic sweetener that is kind of like agave. There's a big bandwagon that got behind agave a couple years,
right.
and the palm nectar is very similar.
Well, this is an amazing story. Now, the question that's on everybody's lips now is
how do we get it?
okay, so you convinced me. How do I get some?
There's one online resource right now that we're working with, and it is a place called Food Shed, and the web site is OurFoodShed.com.
What's the first word?
Our.
Our. O-U-R.
Oh, Our Food Shed. Okay.
And if you go to VincentCranberries.com, you can just click on Buy Online, and there'll be a direct link to that.
Okay.
That's probably the easiest way.
And do you distribute to grocery stores and all that?
We do. We are available in throughout the Northwest United States. In Whole Foods and other regional natural chains. And we are looking at expanding probably into pretty much Northern California. We will run out of capacity at some point.
And then what do you do, plant more?
No. You know what? I think what we would probably do is we would start buying some of our other family members' cranberries there in the local area and possibly beyond that. But you know what, we don't want to forget that this is about making the bank payment. This is about maintaining a lifestyle, and small family farms making an actual product that can go directly to someone's table is a real rare thing, and that's our main goal.
We're all for that. I mean,
Tim, it's a thrilling story, and I'm sure we haven't heard the end of your success, but it's wonderful to hear the first part of it, and you must let us know what other tricks you're going to get up to with all these wonderful cranberries.
You bet. I really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate it.
We appreciate your sharing this with On the Menu listeners. I'm sure they found it one of the more fascinating stories they've heard recently.
Thank you very much. Keep an eye on us.
Okay. You keep us in touch now.
Peter's overdosing on dried cranberries with his morning fruit these days.
As well as your good juice.
And overdosing on the Vincent cranberry juice too. And they're both absolutely wonderful products. But isn't it just a wonderful story?
Yes,
I think it's a story that practically has a happy ending.
And right.
All too few of those these days, and happy ending to the first part of the program, and now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Of course, when we select these products, we first of all have to love the product, and secondly, as we just mentioned, we love the story behind the product. And I think that you'll see that this is appropriately applied to the next discussion we have, our next interview, about Rumiano cheese.
And curiously enough, and I didn't even realize it until we really investigated putting this together for this program, that Rumiano cheese is almost in the same part of the world as Vincent cranberries.
Right.
Because they operate in southern Oregon and northern California. But it's a story that goes back even earlier than 1950. And, of course, in the cheese business. So here is Rumiano cheese.
I've had this long-distance relationship with Joby Rumiano. That is your family name, right?
Correct.
And the company, of course, is Rumiano Cheese, which we sampled. Joby, it has to have been almost a year ago.
No, it wasn't quite a year ago.
It was a long time ago.
Right.
But you're so busy, and it took a long time to get you lined up. I'm just going to sort of jump to the head of the queue here and say that the cheese that you make is award-winning and wonderful, and it's only like a fraction of what Rumiano cheese does. You're going to have to tell us what the rest is about. You're a fourth-generation cheesemaker in Oregon, but you're from California.
Correct. Actually, our cheese manufacturing is in Northern California, so it's right on the coast next to the Oregon border. I live in Oregon.
Okay. And we're talking cow's milk.
Correct. Yeah, all of our dairies are Jersey cow primarily, which are the brown cows and not the black and white.
Yeah, my great uncle's farm, that's what we had, dairy farm.
Yeah, they make good milk for making cheese. They
have pretty big eyes.
Yeah, pretty big eyes, and they're a little smaller than the Holstein. Usually the black and white or Holstein cows are used for bottling milk. Uh-huh. And the brown cows are used for ice cream or cheese, and they make better cheese. They have higher butter fat and higher protein.
Okay, now tell us how long this company's been operating.
Okay, we've been in business since 1921, so this year is our 90th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And we've been family-owned and operated this whole time, and I'm the fourth generation owner. I have one brother and two cousins that are all beginning to get into the business right now. My cousins are just finishing up with college, and my brother is our financial guy down in Willows, where our distribution facility and cut and wrap is at.
Seems like you're very associated with a kind of cheese that's, to me, peculiar to the American, called Jack cheese.
Correct.
Now, can you explain Jack cheese?
Yeah. What happened was, back in, let's say, probably the mid-20s, when we started making cheese, there was, most of the cheese was made in Wisconsin and shipped all over the United States.
Right.
So,
we're not talking to them right now, because we just went through this horrible Super Bowl.
Yeah, exactly. So, what happened was our family began experimenting with different types of cheese and started making Monterey Jack. And we were one of the first companies in California to do this. Monterey Jack was invented by a man named David Jacks, and he invented it sometime, I believe, in the 20s. I'm not quite sure on that, but we started making Monterey Jack, and then we kind of got into a specialty artisanal niche with making a cheese called Dry Monterey Jack, which is an aged Monterey Jack cheese, and that's kind of our staple product. Our family's well known for it, and we've won numerous awards with it. What had happened was they placed a trade embargo on all imports coming from Europe, from the Axis powers, you know, so Americans weren't able to get hard cheeses like Parmesan and Asiago and those types of cheeses, Manchego, whatever it may be, from Europe. So we started making this Dry Monterey Jack, which is a Jack cheese that was aged at least 90 days to 180 days, and we began to sell that in San Francisco to all the immigrants that came over.
Huh.
So that's been a big staple in our company.
I never knew that history of Jack cheese.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and we still make it today, and we have our brines here at our cheese plant. That we purchased this plant in 1930, and we still have the same brines that we used back then. And then on our Willows facility, we actually have, like, instead of caves, we actually have, there were bomb shelters. And we converted those over into dry jack storage rooms. So we have a cellar down there with the houses about 10,000 wheels of dry Monterey Jack. And we also do a Papato version, which is dry Monterey Jack with whole peppercorns.
Yes, we have that.
And that's been one of our most successful award-winning cheeses, too.
Yeah, I mean, they're great cheeses. I'm interested in the story about this so much because I asked you, had you ever thought, here you are, the fourth generation, had you ever thought of doing anything else? And you said...
Yeah, I thought of lots of different things. Of course, always wanted to be a professional athlete in some sport because that would have been a nice way to go. But
what's your sport?
I do everything. Played tennis. I go surfing. I what else do I do? I do a little bit of everything. But I'm primarily a surfer at heart.
Yeah. How old are you?
I'm 34 now.
Oh, okay. I mean, I had no idea what this correspondence. I didn't even know if you were male or female called Jody.
Right. Well, I'm named after a logger in a book that Ken Kesey actually wrote called Sometimes a Great Notion. My mom was reading that when she...
Ken Kesey wrote this?
Yeah, when she was pregnant with me. And what happened was the boy named Joby in the book grew up in a logging family anyways, and he got crushed by a redwood and ended up dying, and she felt bad.
Oh, dear.
Bad about it. Named me after it, and his name is unique and everything. So that's kind of how it is.
You better be careful what kind of books you were reading.
Know.
You could have finished up being called just about anything.
Right, and watch out for those big redwoods.
Right.
When it's windy out, that's for sure.
Now this company sort of reinvented itself a few times.
Correct. Yeah.
I think I read that your father and his brother decided to refocus the company around about 1981. Did I get that right?
Yeah. What had happened was my grandfather passed away in 1978, and my dad was off doing other jobs, and he decided to move up here to our cheese plant in Crescent City to help out with the company. And he was an apprentice underneath another cheesemaker here, and he ended up getting sick, and then my dad had to become a cheesemaker. So he took over his job, and then the guy's name was Joe Richardson, and he ended up passing away. So my dad was kind of forced into the role of cheesemaker here. And in 1980, my dad and my uncle both bought the company, and my uncle ran the one in Willows, and my dad ran the one here in Crescent City. At that time, it was a real simple operation, really small. We did a lot of just cheddar, dry jack, and some Monterey Jack at that time. And then Willows was doing a little processed cheese, but not too much. I can vaguely remember that when I was a kid, there was a processed machine down there that did some processed cheese. which is what we used to do for World War II. That was what
like,
kind of gave
sort
it
sort of like Velveeta stuff. Kind of stuff.
Right, right.
Oh, yeah,
the troops had it in their K-rations.
Yeah, right, with Spam.
Yeah, exactly. So we made a lot of cheese for the government, processed cheese for the K-rations in World War II. But after that ended and the troops came home, they didn't want to see any processed cheese. They had had their fill. Yeah,
I can tell you this: if you shipped any to the UK, I probably ate some of it because we used to get a lot of that American cheese, and we hated it. It was enough to put you off your cheese for the whole of your life.
Right, but, right.
Fortunately, good companies like yours have now convinced the world that cheese is a much more sophisticated and a much more interesting product,
and we're
actually very pleased to eat what you do now, but I get horrified when I see these cheese slices, Kraft singles.
yes, I know the type of cheese that goes into making the.
Yeah, how about laughing cow? I mean,
it sounds like
cheese in it at all. I mean,
it's like a crime against humanity.
We have a big bin, and you know, all the trim and stuff goes into it.
Oops, you mustn't give away those dirty little secrets.
yeah. Well, we don't make processed cheese anymore. We just sell it.
You don't do that. Okay,
no, we just sell our excess to
the
processor.
Somebody else is guilty of doing that, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how large is this?
Our operation?
Yeah.
Okay, we have roughly 150 employees between both of our plants. Here in Crescent City, we've got 35 employees. That includes truck drivers. We have our own milk trucks, and we've got maintenance guys. We have electricians. We've got we run roughly about 16-hour shifts, probably split shifts. The cheesemaker will come in about 1 in the morning.
But you don't have any cows. You're buying from several different local herds that are owned by somebody else.
Yes, that's correct. We have right around 24 different local dairies that we buy from right now.
Mm-hmm.
They're all small family-owned dairies, and they're like us. They're third and fourth generation. Their great-grandfathers were shipping milk here to our cheese plant.
But your cheese, your artisanal cheese, is so well respected. I mean, you win awards from the American Cheese Society and just every place else, right?
Right.
So, but you, in order to survive, you do a whole bunch of other things. This is all these projects you kept telling me about.
Right. My dad and my uncle kind of had to basically survive and build the company up, because what had happened after World War II was the demand shrank, you know, for the types of cheese that we were making. So we had to kind of refocus our, and we hadn't branded back then any of our brands. So what we had in the 30s, we lost in the 40s. And so in the 50s, 60s, we had to do a whole new style of cheese, which was in the food service end. We had to start selling to the other people and letting them put their private label on there, on the different types of cheese, or, you know, selling bulk items.
But what's beautiful is you have preserved this distinctive talent and knowledge for making really fine cheeses. And how do people lay hands on those, Joby?
You can order cheese from us directly by calling our 800 number, 866-EAT-CHEESE, which is 328-2433.
Okay, and your website?
And our website is www.rumianocheese.com, and we're also at facebook.com/rumianocheese, and on the Facebook page I try to update everybody with the articles, photos, video, any information that's up to date will be found on Facebook.
Now, can you also buy your branded product in places like Whole Foods?
Yes, actually this month is pretty neat for us. We're finally getting our brand into a Whole Foods market. We've sold Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and some of the specialty food stores before, but under various different brands. We've got a Rumiano brand. We've got our classic Jack's brand, which is what I sent you guys. We're going to have Rumiano Family Organic in Whole Foods, which should be out by the end of the month. And we're going to ship 5 Whole Foods and Southern California, and then in the Bay Area as well. We also have the California Premium brand, Landmark brand, and our California...
Well, people
Mission.
Should get all this information from your website. Joby, you sound way too busy to actually surf a lot, but...
Yeah. Yeah.
But wishing you good surfing. I'm glad we finally got connected here.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yep, and so if you ever have any questions or need any other cheese, let me know.
Okay.
Well, it's a great family story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
And you know so much about it. It's amazing.
Yes, you're welcome. It was interesting, actually, learning some more of the history, too. Yesterday, I wrote up a history on it.
You boned up for the interview.
Well, I did, because I needed to make sure I had all the facts straight.
Oh,
I didn't want to veer off too bad.
Oh, you're too wonderful. Okay, Joby, I feel like we're almost best friends.
All right, thanks.
So until next time, ciao.
All right, ciao.
And now stay with us as we take a break and join us on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and boy, what a wealth, a treasure of chocolate, of chocolate makers we have in this country.
Don't we, Justin? They seem to be in search of the best at all times and not wanting to rest on their laurels or rest on the legacy of chocolate making as it was practiced in the old world, doing it in a new world kind of way, which is appropriate, I guess, since it's principally now a new world sourced. Well, not really. I guess it was New World sourced before it was Old World sourced, or African sourced, or wherever. I got it all mixed up there, didn't I? But the story behind Moonstruck chocolate goes back literally thousands of years, and a fascinating story of rediscovery, and a product that's available today that has roots way back in the beginning of the chocolate business. Right, sweetheart?
As a regular mystery resolved, a riddle resolved.
A riddle resolved and a taste treat.
A tasty ending.
Yeah, we're consuming it just a little bit at a time because we don't know when we're going to get any more. So let's hear it for Moonstruck Chocolate.
Julian Rose, everything sweet comes out of Portland, Oregon, I must say, and you do too with Moonstruck Chocolates.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, you said you've been a chocolatier for over 30 years?
Yes.
What led you to that?
Well, my parents owned a pastry shop, a chocolate shop in Montreal, Canada. So
okay.
Ever since I was basically 3 years old, I've been involved in sweets or pastry or chocolate in some fashion.
Uh-huh.
And I simply then, it was a natural career path that I specialized in. So I'm actually a trained classic pastry chef that just happened to super specialize in chocolate.
Now, did you do that first in Montreal? Or?
I did. My brother and I inherited the business, and we had the business right up to 2004 before selling it, as I was already traveling quite a bit doing consulting, and my brother had other interests, and we had been involved in the business for so long, kind of wanted a change. So we sold the business in 2004, and that's how it brought me to Portland, Oregon.
Well, you have a wonderful community there.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a close move. I mean, that had to be something more than just a whim.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's funny enough. I mean, I knew Moonstruck before even working here. I was doing consulting and traveling the U.S. and Canada, addressing, I guess, chocolatiers' needs for research and development.
Okay, so Moonstruck as a business already existed.
Yes, yes. And I came here in 07 as their head chocolatier and development expert. So from Montreal to Portland, I mean, it's change of coast, of course, but great cities, both of them are great cities with clear differences, but also kind of very similar differences, very artistic, very kind of trendy and nice fashion, very, very nice people that are pleasant and fun to be with. So it's been, for me, a great move simply for career-wise and also lifestyle-wise. I like the West Coast feel. It's more relaxed, and it's so I'm having fun. And I think it shows in my work for the past 3 years.
We've talked to so many chocolatiers. It's a very exacting career, isn't it?
It is. So we're usually referred to as the chemists of cooks or chefs, because everything is scaled out. There's precision involved, not only in scaling, but in execution. As you know, the chocolate needs to be conditioned, or what's called tempered, in a specific way at a very precise temperature. So we become quite the scientist, I guess, when you're a chocolatier.
Now, the company is how old?
The company was founded in 1992, 1993.
Okay.
So we're going to be celebrating our 20th very soon.
Well, no, you have a whole range of products. I know that.
Do.
But particularly what interested me, I mean, there's, aside from this Valentine's for chocolate, or chocolates for Valentine's idea, there's so much romance involved with chocolate. I mean, you go through its history and the Aztec. I mean, you just, there's so much of it. But this particular chocolate you're working with was even more intriguing. It's the headline was "Lost in Ecuador, Rediscovered in Peru," and it's called Fortunato Number 4.
Exactly.
Made from Pure Nacional cacao. Could you explain this and give us a sense of the wonderment of discovering this, what they thought was extinct bean?
Okay. So, the Pure Nacional cocoa bean, or cocoa varietal, was basically the reference chocolate about 100 to 150 years ago, when explorers and Europeans were still coming to source cocoa for Europe. They would still bring back the Pure Nacional from Ecuador as one of the great chocolates. And basically what happened in the cocoa industry or world, cocoa trees are quite sensitive to disease and mold and insects, so commonly still today there's plantations or varietals that just go extinct because they're affected by disease. And that's what happened to the Pure Nacional from Ecuador over 100 years ago. They got infected by a disease, which basically decimated the whole varietal to almost nothing. So,
as a tree, it lives in the kind of weather conditions and the kind of warmth conditions that would induce that anyway, correct? Because it's a jungle plant almost.
Tropical. So so the common disease that is kind of, I guess, rot that happens at the root system. So that's there's a rot happens, and then kind of from the ground up, it just kills the tree slowly.
So how did you find it? I mean, what an incredible discovery!
Yes, so I had met a gentleman called Dan Pearson, who his son works in Peru and helps farmers bring their produce to market, and this gentleman was also involved in import export to South America. So his son actually befriended a farmer called Fortunato. So Fortunato
is not only
the name of the chocolate; it's the name of the farmer who owns these Pure Nacional trees. So he had this great cocoa. They didn't know anything about chocolate in particular, except this farmer grew bananas and different fruits and also had cocoa. So not thinking too much, he said, well, let's try and see if there's a market for these cocoa beans. And the story goes is they brought back some of the cocoa beans, try to make at a small scale, some chocolate. And that's at the point where I met Dan Pearson. He and I just met under circumstances where I was looking for chocolate equipment and he was looking for chocolate equipment. And we met. He had me taste the chocolate. And specifically, he also showed me the beans. And I saw those cocoa beans, which were much nicer shaped, very, very high quality, great flavor. They were everything that I had been looking for to create the chocolate-covered cocoa beans. So
but how did you know that they were this real Nacional?
We didn't. No, so at a point where I kind of secured a lot of beans for Moonstruck, I had no idea it was a Pure Nacional. And what happened is, oddly enough, those cocoa pods once picked, when they separate the beans from the husk, they noticed some of the beans were white and some of the beans were purple. So that's quite odd. So that's what triggered, I guess, curiosity of getting genetics done on the cocoa tree. So they picked, you simply take a few leaves, and they sent them to the USDA, Department of Agriculture, and they did a DNA testing on the leaves to discover it was a varietal that had not been cataloged ever.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of, now it started getting exciting.
Yeah, weren't you excited, huh?
I was completely excited, but we didn't get validation that it was pure nacional until late last year, about October, November, where we got validation that it was, in fact, pure nacional that was thought to be extinct. And Mars, the large chocolate corporation, Mars finished the cocoa genome last year, and this varietal was not in their catalog.
Wow.
Oh, wow. That's pretty startling.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you known about this about before you've experienced recently? I mean, did you know? Is it like a legend, this lost cocoa bean?
It is now a living legend because no one living had tasted this chocolate in the past 100 years. And, of course, 100 years ago, confectionery and chocolate makers did not have the knowledge they do today of fermentation and roasting and processing. So certainly the chocolate is, aside from not being available for a century, is certainly a discovery for chocolate connoisseurs today.
Now, what's so wonderful about it? Now, I've been guzzling it, but I just think it tastes good.
Yeah. Well, since you've tasted it, I'm sure you noticed that it's for a high percentage cocoa chocolate. So this is a 68% cocoa chocolate.
Uh-huh.
You would expect it to be quite bitter.
Yeah, and it's not.
And it's not. And you would expect it to be slightly acidic, like bitter chocolates
are right.
Usually slightly acidic. And it's not also.
Right.
So it's a dark chocolate that's extremely refined. And I referred to it in a conversation as less savage. That makes sense. Because it's not so much edgy. It's not racy. It's just an extremely great chocolate, extremely smooth. It's also refined, you know, perfectly. So there's no granulation. It's extremely smooth. And it has a long finish and with less acidic notes, not too many citrusy notes either, but it has a nice floral, also kind of red fruits, dates. So it has a nice, even palate on it. And I think it's wonderful myself because when I tasted the first version, like the beta version of it, it was amazing, but this is 5 times better. Now they've did it many, many trials to refine the Fortunato number 4. And the number 4 is actually the fourth trial they did for the genetics, and it's at the sample number 4 that they validated. It was the pure nacional.
Now, is this exclusive to Moonstruck, Julian?
So we have exclusives on the beans, and the chocolate, we got our hands first on the chocolate bars, and we're licensed to make chocolate bars in the U.S., and some other smaller confectioners will probably have some chocolate to make different confections. So probably restaurateurs or nice high-end restaurants will have access to Fortunato to make desserts or different confections.
So how do people get some? Let's make now. You've got our listeners all excited now. Now you have to give us the goods on how people can get some for themselves.
Okay. So we Moonstruck Chocolate Company, based in Portland, has an extensive website. So if you just punch moonstruckchocolate.com, pretty simple, you will see the whole assortment. We're very, say, seasonally driven. So every season we have new products, new packaging. And on the bottom of the page, you'll see Fortunato. So you can click on that and have access, and you can order online for anywhere in the U.S. for delivery. You can order bars, the tumbled cocoa beans. So those beans that we just talked about are called tumbled because it's a process in which we rotate the cocoa beans whole and drizzle chocolate over. And there's a a link on the website where you can see me processing those cocoa beans.
Wow.
So it's really interesting what's original of this product. Not only is it amazing and rare, we have an amazing story about it.
It sure is.
It's from the farmer to Portland and to your enjoyment.
Right now, how do I get a lifelong supply of these?
What a wonderful story! What a real life adventure story!
Yeah, and it's for me, for a chocolatier, it's something that I couldn't even have scripted or dreamt of. It just happened, and everything fell in place. And we're extremely proud of not only the chocolate bar and the beans, but we're proud to be associated and linked to Marignan, which brought the chocolate to the U.S. And we're friends and partners in bringing this chocolate to the American palate.
Well, would you please, before you forget, also be sure to say hello to the wonderful lady owner of Andina, the restaurant, where I understand.
I will.
You said you're going to be doing a fundraiser this evening, so
yep.
Undoubtedly people are going to get a chance to experience some of Moonstruck's other chocolates, as well as this really precious one. And we're just thrilled to have this real-life adventure story on the Menu Radio. So thank you so much, Julian, for joining us. And who knows, maybe you'll discover something else and you'll let us know about that in the future.
Well, I hope so. I'd love to do this every year.
That would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
But well, then I'll be a legend if I do, if we'll pull that off.
That's for sure. Julian, thank you again. And
it was a pleasure.
Keep in touch.
So here we are, ready to take another break, and stay with us, because we have another fascinating story on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And I don't know if it's a fascinating story. I do know that this our next guest, P. Allen Smith, is America's favorite gardener, appearing as he does frequently and making gardening look so easy on the Today Show. Let's listen to his story, because he's now finally written a cookbook.
All about, guess what?
Yes.
How to make use of the produce you happen to have in your garden.
Seasonally.
Seasonally, all of that good stuff. Let's hear it for P. Allen.
P. Allen Smith is, I would say, Allen, if it's okay, I would say you're really America's gardener.
Well, that's very kind,
sure. You were promoting gardening way before it became current hot trend.
Well, we started our production company broadcasting garden tips back in 1987.
So oh, that's early.
Some while ago, and then we... of course, before that, I had done a lot of work at family gardens and also went away to school, went to England to the University of Manchester.
Oh, that's where we're flying in momentarily, like next week.
Now, does the University of Manchester, I didn't realize they had a big gardening program.
They don't have a big gardening
program. They don't.
They have a program in the garden history and design.
Oh, okay. All right.
And then while I was there, I became a certified fellow of the Royal Horticultural Society. And they do. They have a big gardening program, Peter.
Oh, I'm sure they do, yes. Grew up close to the edge of the rhubarb triangle. And you probably know where
that
is.
Dangerous.
You don't know where that is.
No, I don't.
Well, it's in Yorkshire, and it's near the city of Leeds, and it is the world center for the production of forced rhubarb.
Very good.
Rhubarb grown under glass.
I didn't know you knew about that, Robert.
Of course I know. I know everything.
Oh, dear. So, but you come from a long line of gardeners and farmers, actually. You're in Arkansas?
I do, yeah.
So this was genetic almost in you, your ability to garden.
Well, I think, yes. I think there's always been that gene in the family, but also interest, very keen interest on both sides of my family, and everybody... also loves to eat, so there's enthusiasm for it as well.
Now, when did you start doing the gardening segments on the Today Show? Was that before or after your own television series?
Well, my television career started in 1997, and then I began doing spots on the Weather Channel some 5 or 6 years after that, and then I moved to CBS Early Show, and then from there to the NBC Today Show, and I'm the regular lifestyle garden editor for them.
Yeah, and Ann Curry gets so excited over your gardening ideas. I can't quite envision her getting her hands dirty. But
well, they all have enthusiasm for it. Al particularly enjoys
gardening.
Oh, yeah,
I bet he would, yeah.
Yeah, and Meredith loves beautiful flowers, so we have a good time together.
That's great.
Well, now you're on the show, partly because of your great fame, but also because you've contributed something very important to the lexicon of books about gardening and cooking.
Well, thank you. We have produced five books in the Garden Home series through Clarkson Potter, and this cookbook that is our sixth book, and it just came out just about 30 days ago.
Uh-huh. And it's called Seasonal Recipes from the Garden. And, of course, it's natural for somebody who is a gardener to think of this, of what you eat in terms of seasons.
Well, it does. And and even if you can't or don't have the space to grow some of these things, what I encourage you to do is eat in season and buy from your local farmers and market.
Right. And I mean, we just were in Sanibel, Florida, and they have a big farmer's market. But, you know, it's only 2 years old, so this gardening thing you'd think would be really popular.
Yeah, I think it's popular all over the country. You know, in this world where you pick up the paper or go online and check the news, you know, any day you could see another salmonella scare or E. coli breakout and so forth. And I think that's made people think a little bit longer and harder about maybe where their food comes from and how it's produced and maybe how they might supplement their diets with food that's locally grown, whether it's grown by themselves or by a local farmer.
Yeah, I love walking out the back door and picking fresh herbs and tomatoes and whatnot.
Well, it's a great joy. I have to say that, you know, at our farm, we have several kitchens where we do lots of cooking all the time for the show and our online presence. And we have big containers of big clay pots by the door where we have all kinds of herbs growing. We grow a lot of bonny herbs and vegetables, but the herbs are perfect for clustering around the steps or the back door of a kitchen where you can reach them while you're cooking and entertaining in the kitchen.
Well, we've been getting a lot of books from people who are, what do they call them now? I mean, they're foragers, but they call themselves something different, wildcrafters.
Oh, is that what they call them? I thought they called them foragers.
No.
Well, you have a similar setup, don't you?
I do.
You have all these...
we have a lot of wild stuff in our garden.
You have a barrel, half a barrel that grows arugula, and you have a big plastic pot that grows dill, and then you have your favorite fennel patch.
Let's take it over my garden. Tell me, let's look at spring. We've got chilled pea soup with bacon and whipped cream. Now, that's great. The salmon.
Good, yeah.
Oh, your photographs are mouthwatering. This grilled salmon sandwich with lemon dill mayo looks sublime.
Very, very good.
And so, but you have the four seasons, and how many recipes per season?
There are 15 per season.
Okay, not 30.
Well, actually, there are, I guess, 30 per season.
Yeah. So you have.
I haven't counted them in a while.
120 recipes, and in addition to that, you have a resource section and. You also have tips for not just on the dishes, but tips for gardening.
Yes, certainly in the back there's a resource guide, and then throughout the descriptions of the recipes I throw in some tips on how to grow some of these things like arugula and broccoli.
Now, you have also, because you said when you were looking at these recipes, a lot of them are family recipes, some of them are chef's recipes, but they evoke memories of your childhood, and the photographs are wonderful. It looks sort of like my childhood on a farm.
Well, there are some family recipes and some recipes by some friends who are chefs. The rest of them come from right here on the farm. And, I grew up with a lot of great cooks, and so when we did the photography, I really wanted those photographs to evoke sort of, you know, the nostalgia of you know, when I was a kid and enjoying all that great food that was coming in out of the fields.
Right, and you'd have a little story for each of these recipes?
Well, I do. There's a little narrative there that sort of describes, you know, some of my favorites and perhaps a memory or so, you know, about that particular kind of vegetable or how we grew things or how we grow things today.
And then some of these things are interesting, like how you advise to cook fresh corn.
Yes,
Well, don't boil the corn. Steam it.
That's right. Don't overcook anything, really.
And you also, you refer to zucchini as the most overachieving vegetable.
Don't you think that's true?
Well, you know, I've seen this in people not knowing what to do next with this bounty of zucchini and giving them to all the neighbors. In my neighborhood, there was some kind of a rampant borer or something, a zucchini borer. So nobody can grow zucchini in this neighborhood.
Oh, dear. We all need to run that thing out of there.
It came in mid-season. There was one season where the zucchini were flourishing one day, and then the next day they all died.
Yeah, that's that squash borer that gets into
the... Is that what it's
called?
Squash borer.
Yeah, it's difficult to get rid of that. But, yes, we also do a lot of canning here, and we tend to, you know, anything we have extra... an extra bounty of, we try to preserve it in some way. The blackberries we tend to freeze or create jam, and there's a blackberry jam cake in the winter section that is one from my grandmother's cookbook. It's quite an old recipe. It's a very good cake for this time of year in particular.
Yeah, and this after Thanksgiving turkey sandwich with cranberry chutney is gorgeous.
Well, the cranberry chutney really gives it a nice sort of fresh spark.
Is that a way of using up your leftover cranberry sauce with the box and the can on it?
Nothing gets thrown away or goes to waste around here, Peter.
No, well, we were astounded one year because our son, a lot of the time when he was growing up, didn't really seem to be paying much attention to anything other than forking food in his mouth. We go there for the first time for Thanksgiving at his house, and he made his own cranberry sauce with fresh cranberries. And somehow or other, it was just really remarkable because he'd only ever seen it before straight out of a can with the marks on it.
Oh, that's funny, the canned cranberries with the rims on. Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny.
Exactly. It's supposed to be like that so people know it's genuine.
Well, the recipes are delicious. Your photographs are lovely. Your stories are—they're so warm. And I congratulate you on this latest book of yours.
Well, thank you so much. I hope you'll try some of the recipes.
Let me know.
Just email me at pallensmith.com and let me know what you think.
I particularly want to ask your advice for just a couple of minutes before you sign off, Alan.
Sure.
Because this time of the year is difficult for us to be seasonal and local, especially with snow on the ground and ice in the air. So what are some of the things that we should be looking out for in particular?
Well, in the store for eating or ready for the next spring?
No, in the store for
eating. Well, I think now some of the great things that often go overlooked are parsnips. I love parsnips.
Oh, we do too.
And I use them in lots of different things. I love them sort of a half parsnip, half potato puree. Sort of a parsnip potato mash, which is very good with lamb. Carrots this time of year, too. There's a really good carrot ginger soup in the winter section to take a look at. And I was just in the market a few days ago and bought 5 pounds of carrots for like $3. It was just really great value, and I bought several bundles of them. And, you know, they keep for such a long time in the crisper of the refrigerator.
Yeah, the thing that makes me mad is when I want turnips and rutabagas to make something, and they're $4 a pound.
I know, isn't that crazy?
I mean, it's just ludicrous.
Yeah, it really is. And the roasted root vegetables, to your point, are very good, Peter, in the book. And I love to take, even radishes, but turnips and rutabagas, to your point, and even beets. I like golden and red beets roasted together. And
potatoes,
sweet potatoes, all roasted with just some olive oil and garlic and salt.
Okay, well, those are all ideas that were sort of already on our radar screen, but we're glad to have them validated.
Have you made any lentil soup lately with leek?
No, I did see that as one of your recipes, though.
And
I think that one's worth a try.
Yeah.
Peter loves both leeks and lentils, yeah.
We made that one on the Today Show the first week of January.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, Alan, what do you do about weeds? Are you also big on organic, sustainable, and so forth?
Yeah, our entire farm is organic, and so we raise all kinds of poultry and lamb, And we have a market garden, a two-acre market garden, and two orchards.
So how do you get rid of these weeds? I mean, I'm choked by these bindweeds and morning glories
peas. We till the soil at a certain time of the year. We use landscape fabric to put down in the middle of the rows and cover that with straw or mulch. That keeps the weeds down.
Okay, so mulching and then the equivalent effect with your canvas sheets, that's one of the secrets.
Yeah, I think that those filter fabrics that you can buy, those in rolls, we use those a lot, and that really cuts down on the cost of labor because we don't really want to have to pay to have a lot of weeding done. And so by putting that out early on, getting it rolled out and then covered with straw, you want to pin it into place. And then really the only soil that's exposed is right there around the base of the plant, so it cuts down on the weeding tremendously.
I'm good. You're getting me excited for spring, but it doesn't look very close.
good, yeah.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for talking to us about
all this.
It's been
a great pleasure, and check out our website and come see us sometime.
Now the website again is?
It's palansmith.com, and we have regular tours of the farm throughout the year, and our first ones will begin with our daffodil festival. We've planted 225,000 daffodil bulbs over the course of 5 or 6 years. So we have a lot of daffodils.
Oh, wow.
That's the symbol of spring around here. Well, it's been a great pleasure, and let's talk again soon.
Okay, Alan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's time to start thinking about gardening, and I really wish it were as easy as he makes it look. But I so love the produce out of it.
Or even sound, maybe.
Right.
He probably makes it look good, too.
Well, I'm talking about when he's demonstrating on today's show.
Absolutely. He's undoubtedly a wonderful fellow, as were all the people who joined us in today's program. And we hope you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week for more interesting voices at On the Menu Radio.
Bye-bye.